Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Well, this is our last show before the most important elections of our lifetime this coming up Tuesday, and you can bet next week we'll have somebody on to analyze what happens on Tuesday and what, if anything, it means to our day-to-day lives. But today I'm honored to have on peace activist and author Miko Peled. He wrote a book called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He has a very powerful story. So stay tuned, and right after this short break, we'll be back with Miko. Come, you masters of war. Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together. Okay, Miko Peled, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. I was forwarded a talk that you gave. I believe it was in Portland, Oregon, which is one of my favorite places in the world. But it was a very compelling talk, and you have a very compelling story. And as soon as I saw that YouTube, I thought that I needed to get you on the show so you could tell my listeners your story. So, Miko, could you just, as much time as you need to take, tell my listeners about your story, because it is very compelling, and it's very wonderful, and it's very inspiring.
Sure. Well, yeah. Well, thanks for all your kind words. The story is all encapsulated, I guess, in the book. The book is called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and the title really demonstrates, my life and my story. The first part of the story is being the son of a very well-known Israeli general, Mati Peled, who was my father, and having grown up in a very patriotic Zionist home. On my mother's side, my grandfather was one of the signers of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, so she comes from a very kind of notable patriotic Zionist family too. And that was my life growing up, feeling very good about being an Israeli and being very proud of being an Israeli and being very proud of the state of Israel, and really growing up as though the state and my family were one thing. And then the second half of the story, the second part is the journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and that's my journey into Palestine, whereby I finally discovered that this country that I grew up in has a different name, that there is another nation that shares this country. This nation calls all of our victories and successes catastrophes and disasters.
Right.
And this is a very tough thing to learn. It's a very, very difficult thing to learn, because you think that you're a good guy. You think you're on the side of the good guys. So that's kind of basically how the story is laid out. And then you've got portions of it that are historical, that are from documents, from research, and parts of it from things that I learned at home. What probably propelled me to go from one aspect of the story to the other, from being the general's son to journeying into Palestine, it are things that happened to my parents and reactions that my parents have had and other family members in relation to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The creation of the State of Israel in 1948 is a big story, and it's encapsulated in a lot of myths, and it's encapsulated in a lot of stories and novels and movies and so on. The way we are taught about it in Israel and the way people are taught about it here in the United States is a very heroic story of, David and Goliath, the poor Jews, the David, fighting this massive these massive Arab armies, these massive Arab hordes who were intent to destroy it and kill it. But I remember growing up, and of course my father was part of the Israeli army. The Israeli was an army, it was a militia before the state was created. And he was part of this heroic story, so I felt like, you know, this was part of my family. But there's a story that my mother always used to tell me, and that was when she was living in Jerusalem, where she was born and raised. This is 1948. She was a young woman. She had two young children. My father was fighting in the front, you know, for the cause of the Jewish state, of the Zionist state. And as the Palestinian families were driven out of their homes in Jerusalem, we're talking about West Jerusalem, kind of the modern part of Jerusalem, the newer part. Their homes were made available, and she was offered one of those homes. Now, those neighborhoods where the Palestinians used to live still exist, and the homes are still there. These are magnificent homes. And she used to tell me how she was offered one of those homes, and then her reaction was, or the emotions that she felt and expressed were, how could I possibly move into the home of another family? How could I possibly take the home of another mother who now is forced to live with her family in exile? And it really, something about the story stuck and bothered me and just didn't work for me. And it wasn't until I was actually working on the book many years later that I could reconcile what the problem was. And it was that actually she was telling me, she was contradicting the national narrative. She was contradicting this heroic story, because if the story is true, whereby the Arabs attacked us, and then we won, and they all just got up and left, which is the story that we hear, then why not take their home? What's the problem? But she was presenting a moral issue. She was presenting a moral conflict here, that something was wrong. And then she would talk about the people who did take the homes and people who looted those Palestinian homes and took the furniture and the rug and everything. And she remembers seeing people do this and feeling such a sense of shame. So that kind of, in the back of my mind, it told me that something was wrong, and I wasn't quite sure what it was until much later on, until I actually met Palestinians, and they were telling me their own personal stories of being forced out of their homes and so on and so forth. And then as I did a little more research, I realized that there were no Arabs that attacked anybody. It was the other way around. It was the Jewish militias, the Zionist militias in 1947-48 who were attacking the Palestinians and driving them out of their homes. And there was no Palestinian army. There was no Palestinian fighting force ever. You know, so the whole myth about the Arabs attacking wasn't true. So that was kind of the first chink in that massive wall that I had. And then later on, after, you know, my father was, you know, when the state became established and the militia became the army, my father stayed as an officer. He had a distinguished military career, and he was a general in 1967 during that war. And again, the story that we learn in Israel and people learn here in America is that once again the Arabs attacked. This is always the theme. This is the common thread. Once again, the Arabs attacked, and once again, miraculously, the small Jewish state was able to defeat them and conquer all this land and so on and so forth, take the West Bank and the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights. And since they attacked and we won, we're justified in keeping all this land. Well, as I was working on the book, I went to the Israeli Army archives, and I just to see about my father's career. And one of the things I came across were the minutes of the meetings of the Israeli generals, the Israeli top command, just leading up to the 1967 war. And what they're saying is that the Arab armies are not prepared for war, and we now have an opportunity to attack and destroy them once again. This would have been the third time, the third war since the state was established. And I was thinking, wait a minute, what about the threat? People were saying that there was an existential threat, and that's why Israel engaged in a preemptive strike. And here we hear the generals talking weeks and days before the war, and they're saying we have a tremendous opportunity here because the Arab armies are not prepared for war. They're going to need at least a year and a half to 2 years. So once again, another chink in the myth. And then after the war was over, and really the war was over in 6 days, I mean, it's quite miraculous. It's a country that's being attacked from all sides by massive armies, being able to engage in such a huge victory in 6 days is really, it's a myth. I mean, it's impossible. But then after the war was over, my father, still in uniform, stood up and said, look, we now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem. Well, the Palestinians are still here. We still have to figure this out. We're sharing this land. The best thing to do is to allow them to establish a state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Everybody looked at him like he lost his mind. We just conquered all this land. Are you out of your mind? You know, this is, listen, we want to enjoy this. And that's kind of when he parted ways with the rest of the state of Israel, with the rest of the establishment, because the state of Israel began a massive continued a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing from the West Bank. Hundreds of thousands of people were driven from their homes and their land, and massive building continued into the West Bank for Israelis only, once again on Palestinian land. So the same thing that happened in 48 continued in 67, and for in terms of the Israeli establishment, this was really just finishing the job, because the West Bank is really part of the land of Israel and should have been part of the state of Israel from the beginning. Once my father retired, he continued this campaign for the right for self-determination for the Palestinians in a state in the West Bank, and for equal rights for the Palestinians who remained in Israel in 48 and were now Israeli citizens. But both of those things had not been accomplished to this day. He died in 1995. Then in 1997, the last and final blow, I could say, came when my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide attack.
Right.
She was 13 years old, and this was September 1997. She was walking down the street in Jerusalem, downtown, to shop for books and stuff. It was the beginning of the school year. And two Palestinians blew themselves up. Of course, they died, she died, and several other Israelis were killed. And this is big news in Israel, because this is the granddaughter of a famous man. And when my sister finally came out to face everyone, she was asked about retaliation and revenge and all this, and she said, well, no little mother would want to see this happen to any other mother, so don't talk to me about killing more people. And in terms of responsibility, she said, we, the Israelis, brought these two Palestinians to such a level of despair and hopelessness that they would take their own lives and take the lives of other innocent civilians, including my daughter. We, the Israelis, with the brutal oppression and occupation and violent regime against them, this is what we brought them to do, and I hold the Israeli government responsible for my daughter's death. She and her husband, Rami, said this. And she's been saying it ever since. And when I was living in the States at the time, and I came back here, and I felt like I had to do something. I mean, your world is completely shattered when something like this happens. I don't have to tell you this, but I mean, your world is shattered. And I had to figure out something else I had to do. I can't just go back to work like nothing happened. And that's when I began meeting Palestinians and engaging in a dialogue here with Palestinians and beginning learning about the Palestinian narrative and going into the West Bank and going into Palestinian communities over, both in Israel and the West Bank and other parts of the country, and really getting engaged and becoming active and becoming an activist. And more I came to the conclusion that all this hyper, sensitivity to security in Israel and the wall and the massive armament, none of it has anything to do, of course, with security. It all has to do with the desire by Israel to keep the Israelis afraid and keep the Palestinians frustrated. And as I look on the ground, I see every single day, to this day, to this very moment, the massive campaign of ethnic cleansing continuing, the massive campaign of building for Israeli Jews only continuing all over the country, and that in fact Israel had created one state, which is a completely non-democratic state, because you can't have a Jewish state in a country where half the population is not Jewish. And although Israel kind of hides it by saying, well, the West Bank is not really part, but Israel builds in the West Bank, and they keep saying, there's no difference between all these different cities and towns in the West Bank and other cities and towns in other parts of Israel. So in fact, Israel created one state, and it's never going to allow anybody else to create any other state within the boundaries of the state of Israel, which are the boundaries of the land of Israel, which are the boundaries of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So the two-state, people talking about two-state solution, which may have been a solution in the very beginning when my dad was talking about it, late 60s, early 70s, maybe even a little bit later than that. But today it's certainly no longer possible, and by design. The state of Israel made sure that the West Bank could never be turned into a Palestinian state, and that the conquest would be final, and that's exactly what happened. So today we actually do have one state, and the question is, in terms of when I look at it, if we want peace, if we want justice, then to transform this Jewish state, which is a racist idea and a racist state, to a democracy with equal rights for everybody. We have 5.5 million Palestinians and 6.5 million Israelis. That's not going to stay. It's going to change. I mean, the Palestinians will become a majority pretty soon. And to allow a real democracy with equal rights for everybody. And it won't be a Jewish state, but that, I think, is a good thing. mm-hmm. and we'll be able to move on with our lives, which is probably the most important thing.
Well, that's one thing that I see a little bit of divergence on, because many people who are pro-Palestinian rights denounce the one-state solution, and they say it has to be a two-state solution. But I saw you mention in one of your videos that I watched that, or maybe you wrote it in an article, that idea of a two-state solution, people have to get over it. And if we have to get over it, and I say we because I don't live there, so, you know, it's not my state, but if we have to get over that idea of a two-state solution, how do you think the one democratic state, how do you think that that's going to happen?
Well, you know, the problem is, you know, I can understand Palestinians who want their own state. And see the two-state solution as a solution. The thing is, the two-state solution assumes that the state of Israel will be a partner to that.
Right.
The state of Israel will never be a partner to any agreement that allows another state to be established on the land of Israel, which is Palestine, which is, of course, the West Bank is part of. Israel will never allow, no Israeli government will ever allow a Palestinian entity to take the West Bank and establish a state there. Ever. This goes in complete contrast to what the state of Israel is about and to what Zionism is about, which is giving the land of Israel back to the Jewish people. The land of Israel is every piece of the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. It includes the West Bank. So that's never going to happen. So even though it might be a good idea, it might be a fair idea, it's not going to happen. I mean, a Jewish state might be a good idea and a fair idea too, but you can't have a Jewish state in a country where half the population is not Jewish, unless, of course, it's like it is today, which is an apartheid racist state. So how do you go beyond this? Well, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, how did this happen in South Africa? How did it happen here in the United States when Jim Crow, well, the civil rights movement had to battle and struggle against Jim Crow? How does it happen in other countries where non-democratic regimes are replaced by democratic regimes? I mean, it happened in Greece, it happened in Spain, it happened in Latin America. You know, throughout our lifetimes, it happened in many places, and it could be a very, it doesn't have to be violent, that's for sure. I mean, when I say this, you know, the end of the Jewish state, people say, oh, you're talking like, you know, another genocide, and like you sound like Ahmadinejad, and I'm going, well, nobody said anything about violence. Mm-hmm. The transition of a regime, which is similar in many ways, it's not identical, but similar in many ways to what we had in South Africa, it doesn't have to be violent. It could be a peaceful transformation, a peaceful transition. It's going to take a lot of work, that's for sure. And there are the Palestinians, and this is another thing, this is one of the reasons I have so much hope. You know, there's a very serious Palestinian resistance movement, both within Palestine and outside of Palestine, with the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, and groups of students here in the United States and other countries, Students for Justice in Palestine. And they have a tremendous, tremendous program, and they do tremendous work in terms of educating, in terms of forcing companies to boycott and divest from Israel and impose sanctions, and in terms of being out there on the ground every single week and protesting. And one of the leaders of the protest, by the way, Yad Burnat, was supposed to come here for a tour. He was supposed to be here already. And the Israelis let him out, but he had to go through Jordan because Palestinians are not allowed to fly out of Israel. They have to go to Jordan, and the Jordanians wouldn't let him in order to fly.
Wow.
Which is quite ridiculous because, of course, the Jordanians, the Israelis, and the Americans are all working together on this issue. And therefore the Palestinian issue is stuck. And a man of peace like Yad Burnat, who is probably one of the symbols of the nonviolent resistance movement and the peace movement within Palestine, a young, very courageous leader who sat in prison and so on and is still very determined and principled, but he's not being allowed to come to this country, whereas Israeli generals and commanders who are guilty of massive slaughter of Palestinians come here as though they're heroes.
And Netanyahu is welcomed as, you know, practically a god in Washington, D.C. And you also talk about the billions of dollars that the U.S. gives to Israel every year and the effect that has on the problems there.
Yeah, well, you know, when I talk a lot to young audiences here in America and tell them, look, you're giving Israel $3 billion a year. Do you know why? Do you know what they do with this? It's interesting because Americans are probably the least informed people in the world about this issue.
Right.
Yet they're the ones who pay the most for it, and you'd hope that people who pay that much money for something would know, first of all, what their money is used for, and then if they agree, that's fine. But what if you don't agree? I mean, do you agree to giving all this money to Israel is not a developing country. It's not, you know, sub-Saharan Africa where you're building, you know, schools and teaching people how to, you know, fighting tuberculosis, TB and AIDS. I mean, this is a modern country. They don't need this money. So this money and this state holds thousands of political prisoners in its jails, and this state gives you know, less water to Palestinian kids and more water to Israeli kids just because of their Palestinians and Israelis, and they take away people's land and they shoot innocent civilians. So are you okay with giving that much money of your tax money to these people, to that state? And if you are, that's fine, but maybe you're not. And nobody ever asked the question, wait a minute, why do we need to give so much money to this country? Because if you're politicians, it'll kill your career. And if you're just a plain citizen, you don't have time to look into it. But I think I'm hoping that this will change now, and that the Americans will take greater interest in how their money is being used there, and that this whole, there's a wave of resistance that I see that's taking place both in the U.S. and over there, and hopefully this is how the change will come.
And what do you think, what do you think the influence of AIPAC is on this money we give to Israel and the continuing ignorance of, you know, citizens here in the United States?
Oh, it's
with
massive.
The propaganda.
Massive. I mean, the effect of AIPAC is massive. It's almost unbelievable. First of all, if they were able to convince people that this notion of creating a Jewish state is somehow acceptable, and that the notion that people who live here who happen to be Jewish somehow have a right to a country where their great-great-great ancestors may or may not have lived there several thousand years ago, and that somehow gives them the right to go there and live there at the expense of other people,
right,
who are the Palestinians. It's such an absurd notion that you have to be a genius to be able to sell it to someone, and they sold it. They sold it very successfully. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, they created an atmosphere where if you're an American politician, or if you have an ambition and you want to be a politician, a career politician, you have to do two things. Number one, you have to vote with Israel on everything and always support giving Israel money. And number two, you know, every hour on the hour you have to submit how much you love Israel and how you will always do everything for Israel. And without those two things, there is no political career. So most politicians don't care enough. They have other issues they care about. And so they do this. They pay, that's the price of doing business, and they move on and do whatever other things they want to do. And they don't care enough in order to stop and say, well, we're not going to go for this. You know, they care about other things. And that's the unfortunate situation. But AIPAC has AIPAC, and the other groups are kind of connected with AIPAC, the Jewish Federation, other Zionist groups here in the United States. And they have a massive influence, massive, massive influence on how things are done. They also have a massive influence on the media. Nobody dares talk about the possibility of equal rights, because equal rights means the end of the Jewish state. So people prefer a Jewish state that's not democratic, and they talk about this nonsense of a two-state solution as though it's actually feasible, which is not. It's absolutely not feasible. And because that is what you're allowed to talk about. But nobody dares criticize Israel because they don't want to upset this status quo that they have with AIPAC. And the other problem is, of course, that news in America is entertainment. It's not news. So nobody wants to talk about things that upset people.
Right. Well, we're running out of time, but just one thing that I want to ask you. Of course, the thing I think that drew me most to your story was the death of your niece and your family's reaction to it. And I reacted similarly when my son was killed in Iraq. I didn't blame the people of Iraq. I didn't blame the uprising there. I blamed the U.S. government for putting my son there and for the lies and everything that got the U.S. into Iraq and Afghanistan. And how has your family, because of course, if you don't buy into into the paradigm of nationalism. You know, you're a traitor and everything, and I'm a bad mother, of course, and I've been called all those things. Has your family been attacked similarly, and how do you, you know, how do you withstand those and keep going the way you're going, which is very brave and countercultural to your, you know, culture also?
Yeah. Well, what you did was, I mean, you really set the standard. I mean, you came out there and you spoke the truth and you did it in a very brave way. So my hat's off to you, first of all.
Thank
and
you.
I've been following you and admiring the work that you've done from the very beginning. In fact, I have a picture of myself standing somewhere at an anti-war protest, standing with a sign saying, "I stand with Cindy," from a long time ago. But, I think in a way Israel is a lot more tolerant to these things than the U.S. If you're an Israeli Jew, there's a lot more tolerance to dissent. There's a lot more tolerance to there's a lot more academic freedom. There's a lot more tolerance to criticism than there is here. That's not to say that, you know, nasty things aren't being said and written from time to time. But by and large, Israel has a lot more tolerance for that. And, you know, we have our own friends and we have our own circle, so you kind of live and in your own circle. But that comes up from time to time. But I think there's a lot more tolerance. And also Israeli culture has a lot more, perhaps, you know, the bereaved are kind of untouchable in Israeli society. It's true, by the way, in Palestinian society, too. And so they're given a little extra leeway to say things. But I think those two things are a little bit different over there.
Yeah, certainly not here in the United States. Wow.
Yeah.
So, well, Miko Pella, thank you so much for your book and for coming on the show today to talk about it. And where can my listeners go to get more information about your story?
TheGeneralSun.com is probably the best way. They can get the book. They can see stuff that I've written. They can see what other people have said. They can see where I'm going to be speaking. I've got an extensive book, you know, speaking tour coming, you know, schedule. And if they want to just get the book on Amazon, they can get The General Sun on Amazon as well.
Okay, Miko Pella. Well, thank you for your work. Thank peace activist, author, and thank you for coming on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, talk to you soon, I hope. Bye-bye. Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
Well, that was your soapbox for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something, and I hope you were inspired like I was. I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer and connection to Community Progressive Radio, Don DeBar, my producer, Mikey, you for listening and supporting the show, and our very, very special guest today, Miko Pellet. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.